The Unitarian Universalist novelist, Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who died in 2007, was honorary president of the American Humanist Association. Vonnegut once wrote that America has created three great inventions. Now think for a moment, what would those three be? The light bulb, perhaps? The spaceship to go to the moon? What three would you pick? The first great invention, according to Vonnegut, is the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution, essential to our democratic system. The second great invention of America is, according to Kurt Vonnegut, Robert Rules of Order. It was invented by an army officer in the 1860s. Major Robert was a member of the First Baptist Church in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And he was new to the church. He went into a congregational meeting. I don't know what they were debating, perhaps whether to fire the minister. I don't know. They looked around for someone who was neutral, who didn't have a position on the issue, and who could inspire authority. And there was Major Robert. This was during the Civil War, dressed in his military uniform. And they said, "Will you please chair the meeting?" The meeting went on for hours and hours. One story says 13 hours, although I suspect that's an exaggeration. And Major Robert vowed that he would never again chair a church meeting without a rule book to guide him. And so he created Robert's Rules of Order. The third great American invention, according to Kurt Vonnegut, is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. These steps, Vonnegut felt, rank right up there with the Bill of Rights and Robert's Rules of Order as the three greatest inventions created by our nation. The 12 steps are rooted in a meeting that occurred between two old friends back in 1934 when Bill Wilson received a phone call from an old friend named Ebbe Thatcher. Thatcher told Wilson that he was in New York City and he would like to stop by and visit. Wilson was elated. He always admired Thatcher, a wealthy man who was always on the lookout for adventure. Because of Thatcher's playful attitude towards life, people had not only thrown him out of bars and hotels, police had asked him not to return to certain cities. When Wilson opened the door for Thatcher, he knew something about him was different. But it took several minutes to understand what it was. Thatcher was sober. Eddie Thatcher was in New York, and he was cold sober. Wilson poured a drink and pushed it across the table to his friend. Thatcher refused it. "Come on, what's this all about?" Wilson asked. "I got religion," Thatcher said with a smile. Thatcher explained that a man named Roland had rescued him from drinking. Roland was the son of a prominent Connecticut family. Roland had drunk his way through a fortune and in 1930 wound up in Zurich, Switzerland, a patient of Carl Jung. For over a year, Roland worked with the great psychoanalyst and had developed an intellectual understanding of the cause of his drinking. He left Zurich believing he could live a sober life. However, in a matter of weeks, he was drunk again. When he returned to Zurich to see Carl Jung, the doctor was frank. There was nothing more medicine or psychiatry could do. When Roland pressed Jung, the doctor said that he knew of only one hope. Occasionally, he said, alcoholics had shown signs of recovery through religious conversion. So after leaving Carl Jung the second time, Roland joined a fundamentalist religious group called the Oxford Group, led by a Lutheran minister. Just as Jung had predicted, the religious community succeeded where psychoanalysis had failed. The support of a small religious group of ex-drunks helped Roland keep sober. With the evangelical zeal typical of a fundamentalist, Roland then carried this message to Thatcher, and now Thatcher was passing it along to his friend Wilson. The cure for alcoholism, Thatcher told Wilson, was religion. Over the next few days, Wilson began to experiment with the ideas of his friend Thatcher. Wilson started attending the meetings of the Oxford Group in downtown New York City. Prayer and preaching filled the meetings. Afterward, a small group of the ex-drunks would go to Stewart's cafeteria to talk. Wilson felt a special communion among the little group. Because they were all alcoholics, he knew immediately and instinctively that in the small group of four or five people, he could say anything to them. Around their little rear table in the cafeteria over mugs of coffee and too many cigarettes, they would talk for hours. They told one another the most horrendous accounts of their drinking, after which they would laugh unashamedly. In this community, they could do something that none of them could do alone. They could stay sober. In 1935, Bill Wilson left the Oxford Group and took a trip to Akron, Ohio. A business deal he was working on fell through. He found himself alone in the Mayflower Hotel with $10 in his pocket. For a long time, he paced in the lobby, walking back and forth in front of the door to the hotel's bar. As he paced, he saw a glass enclosed sign in the lobby next to the pay telephones. This was a long time ago. They still had pay telephones. And they still, in this hotel, had a local church directory in this glass enclosed sign. Wilson studied the names of the churches, the ministers, the times of the services. Then he chose one of the names, one minister at random, a Reverend Walter Turks. He stepped into a telephone book and he made into the telephone booth and made a call. Reverend Turks happened to be home and answered Wilson, and Wilson began his story. He said, "Reverend, I'm an alcoholic from New York, and to keep from drinking, it's vital that I find another alcoholic with whom to talk." Now, Turk seemed to understand, and he gave Wilson the names of 10 people. I find it interesting that this minister chosen at random in Akron, Ohio, knew the names of 10 people who were alcoholics. The first 9 phone calls got nowhere. Then a female voice answered the 10th call. And after only a few sentences, the woman interrupted to tell Wilson that she understood perfectly and gave him instructions for getting to her home. The woman, Henriette Sieberling, was not an alcoholic. However, she introduced Wilson to a Dr. Smith, a prominent Akron surgeon, whose drinking had gotten so out of hand that none of his patients could trust him. When Wilson met Smith, he explained immediately that he was not there to help Smith, but to help himself. Bill Wilson needed to talk to someone who could understand his situation. He told his story, playing down the spiritual side. He described the obsession that had forced him to go on drinking. He talked about the progress of the illness of alcoholism and its obvious result, insanity or death. They talked for hours. Soon, Smith opened up and was speaking as frankly and as unashamedly as Wilson. When they parted after 11 o'clock at night, they knew something had radically changed in them both. It was a turning point in Wilson's life. After admitting his need to share his problems with another drunk, he had not felt the slightest desire to preach or in any way judge the other man. With a sense of freedom, he felt the two of them growing closer. Their talk became a mutual thing. Two alcoholics had found a new, loving communion. Although it would be 4 years more before Alcoholics Anonymous would have an official name, Alcoholics Anonymous was born on that day in 1935 in Akron, Ohio. Wilson and Smith worked together at first and then separately. They visited hospitals. They tried to talk to drunks in the hospital, tried to talk them into joining their small group. They broke ties from the Oxford group and began to emphasize the value of persons openly talking about their own drinking without judging others or being judged by them. Their only requirement to join the group was a desire to stop drinking. In 2 years, the group had about 100 members, mostly in Ohio and in New York. To promote the growth of the group, Bill Wilson proposed that he write a book spelling out the principles of the organization. After much discussion, the others gave him the go-ahead. Wilson would write during the day and bring what he had written to the evening meeting, where he would read it aloud, discussing it and rewriting it. Now, theologically, the small group was divided. There was no official survey, but people from that time said that about one-third of the 100 people in the group believed in God. Another third were atheists. The final third were agnostics. The theists felt that since the movement had grown out of the Christian doctrine of the Oxford group, they should say so in the book. However, the agnostics and the atheists argued for a stronger emphasis on ethics and no mention about God at all. One night in December of 1937, more than 60 years ago now, Wilson brought the draft of the chapter 5 of the group. And in this chapter, he set out what he called the 12 steps. He had tried to break down the program into its components. The first 3 steps described the central core of Alcoholics Anonymous philosophy. We admit we were powerless over alcohol. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Well, the theists were delighted. They liked the steps exactly as Bill Wilson had written them. On the other hand, that higher power language about God greatly upset the atheists and the agnostics. They felt it was all right for Wilson to talk a little bit about spirituality, but this was going way too far. They argued that all the God talk would only scare most drunks away. The debate went on for weeks. Finally, the theists, the atheists, and the agnostics arrived at a two-part negotiation, a two-part agreement. First, they all agreed that they should always label the steps as a suggested program of recovery. None of the steps would be required for membership. Today, there's still only one requirement for membership in AA, the desire to stop drinking. Second, they agreed that when they used the word God in the steps at the beginning and at the end, they would follow it by a phrase, as we understand him, using the sexist language of the time. The atheists and the agnostics hoped that this would open a door wide enough so that all drunks could pass through, even if they did not believe in God. The theists hoped this would encourage persons to come to terms with what they understood God to be. With this compromise, they agreed to approve the steps. And today there are over 400 AA meetings held in Sarasota each week. and there are tens of thousands of meetings held across the world. Now, over the 37 years of my ministry, when appropriate, I have encouraged individuals in the churches I serve to attend 12-step programs. But the same problem that Bill Wilson struggled with back in 1937 is still a problem today. The references to God are still a turnoff to some people, including many Unitarian Universalists. One member of the first church I served said, "The AA group does not have anything to offer us. It is just a bunch of drunks who have gotten religion. Unitarian Universalists have moved beyond all this stuff about turning ourselves over to a higher power. That fundamentalist dogma may work for uneducated people, but Unitarian Universalists are way beyond AA when it comes to understanding religion." Others agree with this position. Persons who want to stop drinking, but who do not like the theology they find in AA, have established other groups as alternatives. One example that's very successful and effective is Secular Organizations for Sobriety, or SOS. It was established in Los Angeles in the 1980s to offer a non-religious approach to recovering alcoholics. Their suggested guidelines for sobriety emphasize rational decision-making and are not religious or spiritual in nature. SOS members also attend AA meetings, but SOS does not view spirituality or surrender to a higher power as being necessary to maintain abstinence. SOS has over 1,000 meetings across the United States, and they have 2 meetings each week here in Sarasota. Some who are active in AA argue that groups like Secular Organizations for Sobriety are not effective in helping most people deal with alcoholism. Some are convinced that believing in God, believing in a higher power, is essential for recovery from addiction. "In order for me to choose not to drink," said one member of AA to me, "I must believe that a meaning, a purpose to life exists beyond simply seeking short-term pleasure and avoiding short-term pain. My belief in God gives me that meaning. It gives me a sense of long-term purpose. Because I believe in God, I have reason to stay sober. If I did not believe in God, I would find it much harder to resist the temptation of short-term pleasure." Another member of AA said, "Some people say that they don't need a belief in a higher power to stay sober. They say it is the support that they receive from the group and the desire not to let others down in the group that keeps them from drinking. However," he said to me, "I need to believe in God because the people in the meetings can have slips. They can disappoint me. It's my belief in a higher power that helps me stay sober during the hard times when my friends are not there for me." Well, what's my own view? Well, on the one hand, I believe that in trying to deal with the major stresses of our lives, a stress such as trying to stop drinking, it helps most of us to believe that we are part of a community that shares a faith and a power higher than ourselves. My experience suggests that if people believe in a higher power, then overcoming addiction is often easier. We do not need to call that higher power God. We can call it the creative force, or the larger context, or the relational web, or the living, throbbing universe, or the spirit of life. The particular name doesn't matter. Whatever we call it, based on my own unscientific experience, a faith in a higher power helps most people to cope with the major stresses in our lives, stresses like stopping drinking. On the other hand, I know committed atheists who have successfully stopped drinking, who have stayed sober for many years. Based on my unscientific experience, I do not believe that a belief in God is always an essential element in overcoming an addiction. I like these words by a Unitarian Universalist member of AA. He said, "The core element of the third step is this. The only thing you have to know about God is that you are not God." I wish alternative groups like Secular Organizations for Sobriety had existed all over the United States in the 1970s. Back then, I was in my first church. I was trying to work with people in my congregation who were killing themselves, drinking excessive amounts of alcoholic beverages, and indulging in excessive amount of drug use. As atheist Unitarian Universalists, they resisted my suggestion that they consider going to AA. Alternative groups like Secular Organizations for Sobriety, which did not exist then, might have helped some people in that my first congregation. I think of a man who had told me that AA was a group of drunks who got religion. He died 4 years after making those comments to me, at the age of 42, of alcohol abuse. I think of a couple in the congregation who were regularly smoking marijuana. They resisted my suggestion that they might want to look into a 12-step program. I was obviously way too conservative for them. Too much fundamentalist religion in AA, they told me. Their teenage son died in an automobile accident while high on drugs a few years later. Alcoholics Anonymous, or Secular Organizations for Sobriety, two approaches to dealing with the temptations of drug and alcohol abuse. If you need help in this important area, I encourage you to try what feels right. And if it works, stick with it. If you don't have a problem with alcohol, I encourage you to enjoy yourself in moderation. At the same time, I encourage you to remember that for some people in our own community, drinking alcohol would be like drinking poison. And they need our support. They need us always to provide alternatives to alcohol at all our church social events. The honorary president of the American Humanist Association, Kurt Vonnegut Jr., he was raised in Indianapolis, where his parents took him to the Unitarian Church. During the economic depression of the 1930s, his mother became addicted to alcohol and prescription drugs. Seeing his mother's suffering led Vonnegut to his positive view of Alcoholics Anonymous. And near the end of his life, he wrote, "What has been America's most nurturing contribution to the culture of this planet so far?" America's most nurturing contribution. Many would say jazz, Vonnegut wrote. I, who love jazz, will say instead, Alcoholics Anonymous. Vonnegut went on to say, "I'm not an alcoholic. If I was, I would go to the nearest AA meeting and say, my name is Kurt Vonnegut. I'm an alcoholic. God willing, that might be my first step down the long, hard road back to sobriety. America's most nurturing contribution to the culture of this planet so far. Alcoholics Anonymous.